It has been a great honor to work on this archive, and humbling. None of us knew everything. We all knew something. The generations before us knew what they knew, and we improved on it. The next generation will pick up from where we left off. That's how it goes. We have left a huge legacy of knowledge there for the taking. The archive is a very small piece of it. Were there mistakes made? Yes. Was it an incomplete investigation? Yes. Were there things we didn't understand? Yes. White women didn't know much about racism. Middle-class women didn't know much about class. Able-bodied women knew very little about physical difference. Oppressed people were pulling themselves out of a century of abuse. Still, internalized oppression does not depart willingly. We were unpracticed at coalition politics. We had to feminize all the previous theories about systemic oppression. This extraordinary flowering did not get birthed in a perfect state. It was messy, exclusive, inexperienced, underfunded. And because of its strong lesbian feminist identity, it was often rejected, criticized, made fun of, feared, and perhaps worst of all, ignored. Having been vilified by one's own parents kept many women occupied with their personal struggles. Parents dragged kids to psychiatrists when homosexuality was considered a mental disorder. Lesbian children were taken away and given to straight people. Dykes were beaten in alleys outside of women's bars and tires slashed. In or out of the closet, most women were struggling to get equal pay. Their bodies were humiliated by doctors. They were living in marriages that traumatized their hearts and safety, raising children without support. Women from multiple cultures had multiple issues in which to contend. So it made sense that lesbians began to build an alternate culture. Many women went to Laney College for $2 a credit to learn carpentry, auto repair skills, bookkeeping, and haircutting. A barter and trade economy was informally put in place. Women shared cars to get to events and rallies and lived together in big houses that no one could afford if they were there on their own. Women prioritized their hard-earned cash. Time and time again, they bought tickets to lesbian cultural events. Not just once or twice a month, but multiple times each week. Lesbians called themselves lesbians, keeping pressure on the government, on media, on the gay movement to end the stigma of invisibility for lesbianism. All this without cell phones, internet, or Facebook. It was an in-person, up-close, and personal political movement. However, to this day, most books, articles, lists skip over women's music. Looking online for lists of lesbian songs, one is hard-pressed to find any of the artists from the women's music included in those lists. The surface is barely skimmed in this research, but one thing is certain. The women's music that came out of Oakland, California was at the tipping point of the feminist revolution of the 1970s. The music continues to this day, challenging inequity, building and sustaining community, supporting local artists, uplifted by national treasures, and connecting with global activism. Women's music is a concinity of sound. Orchestras, big bands, choirs, rock bands, jazz quintets, drum ensembles. The story includes artists, producers, photographers, sound engineers, graphic artists, music distributors, arrangers, managers, agents, audience, and you. And there were dancers who choreographed to women's music as their primary material. And there were poets who had a major influence on the music community. We could not have had such illuminating conversations if it were not for Maya Angelou, June Jordan, Audre Lorde, Angela Davis, Alice Walker, Adrienne Rich, Joy Harjo, Sherry Moraga, and Oakland's own Pat Parker and Judy Gron. We built on their work. And there were organizations and bookstores and coffee houses and restaurants and all over the world an explosion of press collectives and newspapers, all part of creating space for lesbians, all before cell phones and social media. And the audience that chose again and again and again to spend what little extra money they had on women's music, that was so essential. These women were the glue, and without the glue, women's music would have come unstuck. There is no doubt that Meg Christian, Margie Adam, Chris Williamson, and I made the first highly visible splash on the palette of women's music and lesbian culture. A half-hour documentary was made in 1974 called Come Out Singing, produced by Lynn Lippman. It was aired on PBS Los Angeles, and Lynn won a local Emmy for her work. The Women on Wheels tour in 1975 was performed in large venues in seven California cities. The tour introduced women-identified music to thousands of people and was noticed by such media outlets as Rolling Stone magazine. Marianne Schneller put up the initial funding, which she borrowed from her father. She was a valiant producer, along with dozens of other women who joined in, donating their time and skills to make this tour happen. It was a pivotal moment in the evolution of what became known as women's music. Alex Dobkin from New York, who released Lavender Jane Loves Women, and Maxine Feldman from Los Angeles, who performed Amazon Women, led the way to writing the most specific and out lesbian songs. And Chris Williamson's inspirational Changer in the Changed, released in 1975, has sold over 500,000 copies and continues to sell to this day. All women record labels, distribution companies, and concert promoters sprouted up across the country and in many other English-speaking countries. In Chile, once the Pinochet dictatorship was brought down, Chilean women singer-songwriters began to investigate feminist music. The fact that there seems to be a new curiosity about the work is very welcomed. And it's never too late for the living nor for posterity to try to tell the truth. In these interviews, we have an opportunity to hear from 24 dedicated artists who have a strong identification with Oakland, California. I thank them. Several young people have worked on this project. It's been hugely fulfilling to feel their curiosity and enthusiasm for these interviews. It was not just another day at the office for any of us. COVID stopped the in-person work and we moved to Zoom. I encourage us all to take something away from each artist that might elevate our own work, our own sense of the artistic process, our collective understanding of how social conditions and geography define our contributions. The telling of a story starts with a point of view. History is not a fact, it happens. And then it is the telling and retelling of the stories that we come to understand events, ourselves, and each other. To tell the story of feminist, lesbian, woman-identified music, what came to be known as women's music, requires multiple voices and genres. One thing is clear: no matter where we come from or what our experience, if we don't see that feminism means all women, then it doesn't work for any of us. That thought came from Ginny Z. Burson. We who love women's music, we whose lives were changed by its very existence, are now able to document it as accurately as possible from all corners of the world, each contributing what she knows and archiving collective knowledge and memories, leaving it somewhere to be discovered. And by the way, women's music did not replace softball. We are older now. We are the elders. We are holding each other together, creating living spaces for elder care, taking on cancer like it was a flaming dragon, warriors in our youth and warriors still. I quote June Millington: "There is nothing like going through 6 months of chemo and a couple of surgeries and radiation to raise the quality of everyday appreciation and mindfulness of the gift of life." So, wherever you are in the world, leave a trail. Remember, the world is and has always been changed because of a song.